This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shan Gallagher, and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann. I'm at Otago Polytechnic Te Pūkenga today, and I am joined by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How are you today?
I am very well indeed. We've had quite a lot of rain, which is unusual for us.
And we've had quite a lot of sunshine, which is unusual for us.
Well, there you go then. It must be about time that you moved back to Dunedin.
Yeah, bring the sun back. I took it with me back to Whakatane, and now I need to bring it back to Dunedin.
Who are we introducing today?
It is my great pleasure to introduce our colleague and friend, Henk Ruit. Kia ora,
hello,
Henk.
Mawira.
Thank you for joining us today.
Hello, Sam. Hello, Mawira. Yep, it's great to be with you guys.
Henk, you are joining us not from across the desk, but from across the world. Where are you?
I'm in Boston, Massachusetts, in the US of A. And it's a great privilege to be here. I was saying to one of our colleagues that are also here earlier today or yesterday. Time goes really quickly when you travel like this, right? That one of the first places that I visited when I went overseas, the first time, I went to New York and Boston, and the same conference venue where this conference was held was where the previous one was held. It was in November of that year, and it was the first time I saw snow as well, because it started snowing in Boston at the time. And it was very interesting to sort of come back. It almost felt like full circle type of thing, you know. And it felt like, it's the same old building.
What was that conference you went to those years ago?
Good grief. Yes, it was a conference on military technologies of all things, because that was the space that I worked in at the time. And as a youngster, this was probably 1995, 1994. So, it's a long time ago, right? It's 30 years pretty much this year. And it was the first opportunity for me to travel overseas. It was a really long trip, first to New York, where I had my first experience of an underground train. I can tell you, I was scared out of my skin on that thing, because all these weird people, and they're all getting on the train and they crowd up. And I'm from Africa, there's no crowding there, and so on. But by the time I got to Boston, it was easier, and it was good fun. Yeah.
And so, what was this conference?
This conference was the Academy of Management conference, and this is a huge thing. They attract in excess of 10,000 people every year, and it's and quite a few thousand people also submit papers for this. So we were quite happy to be chosen to present some work with colleagues from Denmark and Canada as part of a panel discussion on learner agency, putting our learners first and things, specifically talking about agency and how that impacts on the learning delivery and the modes of delivery. And it gave us an opportunity to also meet with our colleagues from Denmark and Canada that we just see like we are here, legless on Teams and Zoom. So the first time we saw these days, we went, "Ha! Oh, there's the legless days," you know? So, that's pretty cool.
So how well did the, or how did the presentation go down?
Well, things went well. You know, it was the first time that we could present as a cohort. So, and that was really good for us to go through the motions in tandem and to hear ourselves talk through the process and what we had to say from different perspectives. Because we come from very different worldviews in a way. The Danes, for example, very rigorous in their theoretical approach to things, you know, where they quote their philosophers left, right, and center. You know, they start with Kierkegaard, and then they go Camus, and so on, and Rousseau, and then, you know, we from New Zealand go, yeah, cool, okay, what shall we do about this? Okay, no, we can see how this could work for us, you know, and we make a plan. And then the Canadians sit there and they go, yeah, let's make a plan. Let's get this, you know, into some sort of pipeline with learners. It's fascinating. But I think the best thing about this is that we have these different views, but we're talking the same language. We have the same passion for shifting the way that we deliver education dramatically. Because we truly believe, all three cohorts, that the world has changed. And we can do so much better. We can do so much better for our learners. We can do so much better in terms of agency. And I mean, I didn't even try, we don't even try to explain or express mana, for example, because, you know, that's still a concept that I don't get my head around properly. But it's so much more. And if you think about that from an Indigenous perspective, we are leaving people behind in that space. We are not doing what we could to have our learners really experience things in a positive manner, going through the whole process of learning. And it is interesting that that is the same for the people in Denmark and in Canada. We all have the same feeling that it's not working so well for us. So that is a big driver for us. And yeah, people are interested in that. And we found other people that are starting to talk about this here, not so much at the same level of emotional connection that we are, but they're starting to see that things are shifting, you know. And I was in one of these papers and presentations where the question was on the table saying, here's the drama, you know, we're getting less and less people wanting to join us, and the pressure is up, and tenure, and the professors, and we're losing people, and how do we keep things going? And it dawned on me that they start from the wrong premise. They start from a premise that says the university has to look like this. And the university is a business. It is selling a commodity called knowledge and degrees. And because of that, you know, there's an expectation. It says on the tin, you pay us, you pitch enough times, you get a degree, and you get a job. That's a fallacy. Because that's not what the university is about or what higher learning is about. And so when I questioned that premise, I could see the utter confusion in the room. I said, well, imagine for a moment that that is not what is written on the tin. And then I sat back.
The Academy of Management sounds like it could be a really progressive organization about change, or it could be very stuck in a rut. What's your feeling from the sort of, if this is the world's management scholars coming together, what's your feeling about the future of living in a changing world?
Good question, Matt. And the sort of an ambivalent feeling, because in some of the sessions, there was the experience that these people are really fighting to start to shed the skin, really trying to go through that metamorphosis. And in other places, it was, let's see if we can ask a better question so that we can survive. Yeah, it was like, no, your questions are starting from the wrong space. You know, on the strategic management side, for example, there's the quest for renewal. How are we going to become more energetic again? How do we bring the young people in? Because, you know, the panel looked at themselves while they were sitting there and they were saying, look at us, old, white, ready to, for retirement. Where are the young people? And we looked around the room and, yeah, old, white guys. And they said, we need to shift this. What are the questions that we can ask? And there was a lovely lady on the stage with them. And she said, yeah, we need to revitalize the questions and the theories of strategic management, you know. And one person was trying to get a word in edgewise, saying, maybe we don't need so much Greek in all these theories. Oh, no, we need to be rigorous, you know. And we need to. And then they sort of had a hierarchy where they said, description is okay. Correlation, that's what, you know, that's really a step up. And causation, that's the holy grail. And I was sitting there going, no, not really. Because, you know, we're talking about living organisms, businesses, enterprises being living organisms and unpredictable. And we saw what happened during and after COVID. Totally unpredictable. People don't want to go back to work. They want to stay in slippers. But they also want to have community. Because that's the other thing, Sam, that came out very clearly in many of the sessions, the need for community. And Mintzberg said yesterday, you know, we can't have a world where we innovate if we don't meet in person. You know, and I thought, yeah, that's exactly right. We need to be there to talk and interact with each other. And that was another theme that came through, that people are saying we are starting to feel more revitalized and so on. And I felt the same. It felt very clear to me that some areas are a bit stuck. Others are starting to move in different directions. But there's energy because people are in the same room discussing things, throwing ideas around and rubbing shoulders. That makes a big difference, yeah.
Let's squeeze in the first of your music choices. Let's have Pink Floyd, Wish You Were Here. Why this one?
Oh, it's a firm favorite. It goes back, obviously, to the year it came out, I think in the 70s, 74, 73. This is the year of many decades for me, right? And it was one of the first records that I procured. Shortly after I listened to Dark Side of the Moon, this one came along and I listened to this one. I thought, this is a real step up from Dark Side of the Moon. I was a teenager. This was dark. It had all those brooding things going. It was the first time that I heard commentary against capitalism so prominent in the songs without being in your face. And I thought, how subtle is this? Better listen to it quietly at night, or not let people hear about it. Yeah.
Leave. We're just two lost souls swimming in a fishbowl, year after year, running over the same old ground. What have we found? Same old fears. Wish you were here.
You just had so much really amazing stuff to say in that first section. I've got a list of things to talk to you all about from that. So the first thing I want to talk about is you were talking about how education across these areas that you're looking at the moment is not working for Indigenous learners. And in my own work, I know that Eurocentric models of education, which we still base our entire education system on, wasn't designed for our Indigenous learners or by our Indigenous learners. The models of assessment are Eurocentric models. They're not Indigenous models. So the whole system just doesn't work unless we continue along this colonisation pathway of forcing our learners to think and behave and see the world in a Eurocentric way. So how do we actually flip the model so that it truly is learner-centered?
Oh, that's again, it's a fantastic question and a set of statements that you've made there, Mawira, because you won't be surprised if you hear what I'm going to answer to that. First of all, you know, we can start with the Canadians and where they are from and how they see the Indigenous people and how their system is responding. And it is not responding well. I would imagine from my bit of experience there at Humber College that they're trying very hard. They have an Indigenous panel that is now and does have a voice in how things are being done, and they are making a contribution. And because Humber is really focused on vocational learning as well, they're saying that, look, we can't just be theoretical about things. We want to publish things that make a difference. So they would cite, for example, work by people from the Indigenous community by saying, Elder John Hopkins said this, you know, in a discussion, and they would give that voice the appropriate place and gravitas that it needs to make the point. And so there's that progression going, and I mean, you know as well as I do that we are making progress in New Zealand. It is slow, but it is progress. Now, here's the question: if you're in Denmark, you know, with a Nordic view on this, what do you think when you're in Denmark about indigeneity, if you want to use the word indigeneity? What would you say? You know, and the Danes were just sort of stupefied for a second, and they said, yes, we are sick and tired of Anglo-American ways of doing things for us as Nordic countries. We have a different way. We have a strong philosophical position that we can take. We also want to learn and set things up that fits closer with who we are. So here's the interesting thing. Peoples across the world are starting to say, we want things that work better for us from a cultural perspective and from a perspective that will enhance where we go for ourselves. And we don't want to be told, the ways that we do. So I was asking that question from them, trying to see if they say, oh, it's okay, the European approach, but it isn't. So yes, design for people, by the people, in Danish. They want to teach in Danish. Yes, they want to make sure that their work can get out there because they want to communicate. What we're talking about here needs to get out there. Now, how do we get that out there? Through publication, through going to conferences, by talking about it, like we have done today. And that is a way of doing it. So unfortunately or fortunately, we need to find ways of communicating. And sometimes we need to publish in journals that will be read by others, ourselves included, but others as well, so we can start to understand that there is a community out there that do feel the same as we do. And that has value. It does get traction. People do read it. But after all, publishing for me is about communicating what we're learning and what we know and what we're hoping to know next. That is what it is. And if I work in the Tupukinga space in New Zealand, my research is in the space where I want to see how my work contributes to learning. I don't care about research that is not focused in that space. So I think when you look at the work that is coming out of Capable in general, it has that slant. What we need to do is to make sure that people understand the incredible value of that work. That's also our responsibility. So that's how I see it. I hope that answer, it's a long answer, but I hope it gives you at least the feeling of, look, it's not all that hopeless. Things are going, in a more positive direction.
Having just spent time in Canada and looking at the issues that the Canadian Indigenous folks are facing, we're facing the same kind of issues here. In fact, Canadian society is facing the same issues that society in Aotearoa is facing across the board, from education issues, justice, climate, health, the whole lot. The story is the same, just the place is different. But in a lot of ways, it seems like we're much further ahead here, particularly in the Indigenous space. And I think about what you were saying before about the kind of changes that need to happen in the Academy of Management. When you're talking about publishing for the Academy to read, well, I challenge that. I think maybe actually we need to think about things like our PBRF, our Performance-Based Research Fund, which requires us to publish in A-level journals and at that high level where the Academy reads it. But what use is it if the Academy is the only audience and the people that actually who are at the coalface making the change haven't got access to it because of paywalls or membership or the kind of language that's used? What is the point of writing where people who actually need to do the work to make the change can't access it?
Mm. My view on that is that we change the system from the inside. I believe that you get in, the whole story of the wooden horse, right, was all about getting inside the walls and then changing things from the inside. It's a pretty crude example, but if you're on the inside of a huge organization like Academy of Management or any of these other big Western organizations, and you get your voice heard there, that is where you ignite others that feel the same way. And that is how we bring about change. It's slow, but it brings about the change. I heard many times in the past week where people are saying, here we are, we've paid hundreds of dollars to get to Boston and to get into this conference. And I had to pay another $120 to get into a certain track on top of everything else. So to get through the paywall, and when we were on the inside, we were saying, this is no good. Why is this behind this incredible paywall when we all agree that we need to change and that we need to shift things along? We understand we need money to run the show and to make this prestigious enough so that we can attract the right brain power, right, if you want. At the same time, why is it so exclusive? So no, there's already a grumbling going on in the stomach of that beast. It knows it's not well, and the change is coming. So my view on all of these things after a few decades of going around the sun is that you can be outside the walls and scream and shout, you know, and you can sneak inside and speak to the powerful people and convince them otherwise. And there's no need for the fight. So the PBRF in New Zealand has got its own issues at this point. You know, we're out of money. And they can fund only so much. And I think there's a push in the country to say, but what is the value of this? And that question is worldwide. Mm. I see this at Humber. The people that we deal with there and at VIA in Denmark feel very similar to the way that we do. And I can now understand why we ended up in this global politic alliance discussion. I know our leaders are not really engaged in this anymore, but we are helping on keeping this going because we feel similar. We feel like we have brothers and sisters now.
Does it bother you that the leaders, those with the authority to actually put change in place, are not in the kōrero anymore? Does that bother you?
No. Okay. No, because, you know, it's the role of leaders to set things up and then to point to people to say, here's the opportunity space. You know, and we prepare ourselves for situations like this through the discussions like the one that we're having now at this point is the preparation so that when the situations arrive, there's a serendipity trigger. You know, there's a moment where we go, hey, what? Surprisingly, we have the same story here. We can work on this together and we can shift the system slowly from the inside because we have agency. And our leaders allowed us a certain level of agency up to this point, we can make valuable contributions. And that is how I see it. You know, I think that is truly the way to go. So, yes, they've opened the door. We threw it, you know, and now we're unstoppable. You know, the way to stop us now is to say you can't go speak to these people. You can't get on a plane and go speak to them. What would be the value of that, right?
Well, that's happening.
I mean, it could happen. I know, but it would change. It could change. I mean, it is a temporary state of affairs to my mind. We're going through major upheaval and change in New Zealand with this big organization, first of all. And secondly, we are in deep debt, and I understand that as a nation. But you don't save yourself out of debt. You work yourself out of it. And I think part of what we do is working ourselves out of it. I'm very positive. I'm very optimistic.
Bubble Sprite of the Forest of Orokinui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, nga mihi aroha nui ki a koutou, ko tahu ahau. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, so it's so important that we give ourselves and each other the love, the kindness, the compassion, the time, the space, the energy, the support that we all need and we all deserve. I know for myself the living world is a constant companion and comfort to me, and I speak to you now from my heart's home, Orokinui Eco Sanctuary, as the wind is gently rustling the leaves of the trees that I'm gazing at and all their differences, all their beauty, of course, serve as reminders of our own myriad forms throughout our lives. How to welcome and be grateful for each one. I know that we've all moved through several different times of transition in our lives, and particularly over the last several years, we've had to make quite fast and intense changes and transitions. And so it can be a great gift for us when we have the opportunity to slow down and take things slowly, do one thing at a time, really be present with that action and really enjoy our powers of observation, really tuning in with our five senses and appreciating how far we've come. It can be a great gift to ourselves in these moments when we're doing the dishes or we're sweeping the floor or we're making someone a cup of tea, to look back over our lives and think of all those decisions that we've made. And of course, all those decisions really were the right decisions, because here we are right now, just in the place that we're meant to be. And of course, throughout the last several years, we have been in positions where those decision-making powers have changed in the way that our lives flowed, had to change. And so now it's such a gift, of course, to ourselves to really relish those moments where we can choose to do things for ourselves in ways that really nourish us. So I hope that for you, you're finding moments in time where you can slow down and give yourself that gift of your own perception, your own power to enshrine every moment with your own unique set of eyes, your own unique consciousness. And of course, fundamentally, we are this awareness, we are this consciousness. So when we can really take a step back from the hustle and bustle of our lives and all the many different ways of being that we have to move through each day, and just relax back into that awareness that we are, it's such a relief. And of course, for me, being able to speak with you and be part of the show has been immensely helpful. So I want to say a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. Really, for me, this show has given me an opportunity to experience things quite differently and to have that opportunity to take a step back and recalibrate and share my thoughts with you all. And it's a great pleasure and privilege to get to do that. Another thing, of course, that we can do, which can be really helpful, is allow our body to lead the way. And this is a lovely companion that we have in our lives, our bodies, that help us to move through life and constantly are there supporting us. And when we give our body the opportunity to lead the way, it can be, again, just really tuning in with those senses and finding that calmness, that peace, that serenity within via one of those senses or several of those senses. And for me, that can really be sound. So at the moment, I'm just really enjoying hearing the wind gently rustling. So I hope for you, you can find some really helpful things for yourself, and I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Hank Root. Hank, before Tahu, you mentioned having a positive approach. What's the role of a positive mindset for you?
That's a good question again. Well, I think it comes from a deep spiritual space, and I'm quite keen to quite open about that. I'm a Christian, so I come with a very positive mindset from that spiritual place. I believe in the potential of humans to make a change and to be change agents. I believe in a higher power that will support us through our best endeavors for this. And I'm very proud of my Western philosophical background, from the Greeks up to where we are now. You know, I know that there's an incredible push against Western powers and so on, but I truly believe that Western philosophy has much to offer the world still. We should not confuse colonialism and Western philosophy necessarily. These things are not the same. We should not confuse the ways of knowing, the Western ways of knowing necessarily, with Western power grabs. That is not the same. It would be the same to say, you know, Maori ways of doing and thinking and coming to know could be colonizing as well. You know, it could be, and it might be, but that would be the wrong way to look at it, and we would all agree. So we would, and that's why I'm positive. I tend to find places in my mind where I can see between these things and look for the positive elements that I can take forward to bring about the change and to live my life in a positive way. It's a long and roundabout way of saying I have hope, you know, and I know the world is in a space where there's a heap of futility, but that's not me.
So at a conference about management, and I'd like to think that management isn't a euphemism for business, but a euphemism for leadership or something like that. Do you get a sense of positive change? Do you get a sense of hope?
There was a mix of that. There was the inevitable discussions around climate change, and we all do. The inevitable discussions around the deterioration of Western culture and the inevitabilities of the machines are ruling us. There were even papers saying, you know, the research is dead, the robots won, you know, that sort of thing. And but then you go into those meetings, and that's all just little teasers to get you in, right? Because then you start to listen to how people really work hard to look for solutions and other ways of doing things. What I did not see was space for indigeneity. And that is to be expected. This is Boston, Massachusetts, the USA. This is the world, right? But then there were so many people from all over the planet there, and they were having different narratives, you know, and you could see them sitting there nodding quietly and then having discussions. So because this thing is international, as I say, there's a discussion going to say, we hear about AI, but here we are, let's talk about it. Let's look for the positives. And there was a heap of that going on. Let's look into the face of climate change and say, right, okay, we've been doing a heap of things, you know, we've been putting the oil, so to say, back into the earth, and it's not shifting us. What's happening here? We've replaced it with something else that's as dirty. Now, we need to find a way of being to get to a point where we can still thrive and find other ways. We need to put our brains into this. And so as a management organization, I heard many discussions that is not about management or business per se alone. It's about taking leadership positions and saying, you know, we need to move things forward. Yes, there was a heap of stuff around management and so on after COVID, you know, the normal stuff. How do we get people back into offices and so on? But that discussion is almost dead in the water as we speak.
Let's squeeze in the second of your music choices. Let's have Goodbye June, Daisy. I hadn't heard of this before. Why this one?
I listened to a podcast, just like podcasts like this one, by a guy called The Rock Professor. And he's been a rock DJ, if you want, in the old terms, in South Africa for decades and decades. He worked in South Africa and Australia and so on. And he has this once a week, 3 hours rock music podcast with curated music by a human. And, you know, he brings 6-7 songs in a row that are just brilliantly put together, and you move through the themes. It's a full-on experience of listening to music. And one evening, this show is on a Thursday evening in South Africa, so I get it in the morning, and then I sort of save it away. And then a Friday night, I open some wine, and I sit back in the dark, and I listen to this. And I was just – he started with this song, and it was so positive. It's a love song, you know, and it's almost naive and positive. And I thought, yeah, that's what we need. That's what we need.
Coming back energized, Hank?
Yeah, absolutely. Can't wait for next week. There's a heap of work to be done. I have an agenda, Sam. I have an agenda to slay the word assessment. I want to slay the word assessment because it is not agentic. The process that we follow is so positive in many instances, and we bring people so far. And then we get to assessment. And even though our practices in Capable is way ahead of things that I've seen, and when people hear this, they just go, how come we never thought of this? And I'm thinking, we need to preserve that and we need to step it up. So the word assessment is out. And I think, there will be skulls in Valhalla. I think we need to shift this thing because that you can work on agency and agentism, and you can work on mana related things, and then you say, can we have a mana enhancing assessment? And I think, no, you can't have those words in the same sentence. It needs to be slayed.
with the capable process, which is a beautiful process. I mean, I've been. I think of my 5 tertiary qualifications, 4 of them have been gained through Capable and the process. But I've noticed a change in that process over the last while that I think is coming from some sort of outside pressure to take away the true learner-centered approach and almost restore that cookie-cutter model of education. How can we turn that back to true learner-centered approach as it was in its, you know, originally intended?
Yeah, it's difficult, Mawera, because this is driven worldwide, and we talked about that here at length. It's driven by financial models. When we have templated delivery, we can scale it. And it is because people think about scaling as bums on seats, that we sit with a situation of cookie cutter type approaches, and it's the easiest way to fall back into that. That is education 1 and 2. That is not going to work for people. It is not going to get bums on seats. So the unfortunate reality is, you know, the cookie cutter thing will kill itself. It will eat itself. So given that we know this, we have a job ahead of us to make sure that people understand that what we are doing is in fact the right direction, and we need to come up with ways of scaling so that, you know, those that are driven by the financial imperatives can see that this is the way forward. We have not been able to convincingly state our case around scaling yet, and so therefore I think, you know, it is our own fault that we are seeing cookie cutter approaches returning to some degree. And I put that squarely behind my name and other people that have been around the block. You know, we've been a bit careless in thinking we onto such a good thing that nobody will take it away. No, we need to just push back a bit and work about, you know, on the solution.
And I think that in an environment that's becoming increasingly VUCA. What's that? Volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, VUCA-filled. I don't know if you can use it like that, but I'm going to. Then the response, and probably the natural response, is to become more risk-averse.
And so indeed.
So we need to continue to demonstrate that self-determination and rigor are compatible.
Precisely, and
that's
right.
That's the other part of the agenda we need to work on, Hank.
And scalable.
Pushing back against those outside forces that are trying to take away what makes it special, which is that true learner-centered model, which just doesn't exist widely outside of the space, and to lose it would be an absolute travesty, unforgivable.
Very quickly, Mawira, you were going to ask a question about co-governance.
Oh, yes, I was going to ask. I don't know if there's a quick answer to that. We'll see how we go. We might have to put it on speed up. Okay, so your agency has been a real strong theme for you from the beginning of the kōrero today. Co-governance is all about agency. Did you hear much conversation around notions of co-governance in your conference?
No.
Damn.
Simply no. It's before the conference at Humber, where we worked with our colleagues there on a research workshop with people from 9 other countries in the room, young people and some people with more experience. We had a bit of a discussion around that because we invited people in some of from the Indigenous department to come talk to us about other ways of knowing. And, you know, so small shuffles, Mawira. And but co-governance is a scary thing. And so, you know, I don't think in other places in the world it's as, you know, we are far enough down the road to get the discussion going without getting it snuffed out in a moment. So
it's funny to think of co-governance as scary. It's been operating here for such a long time, just without the fanfare and the trumpets and the warning sounds. And I think that the scary nature of it is manufactured to a degree, which is kind of, that makes me sad, because that's all about taking away agency and deepening that colonized thinking, and that's real sad.
Yeah, I can see where the fear comes from, Mawira. Remember that I said somewhere during this discussion that we need to understand that colonization can come from anywhere, you know, and recolonization and decolonization, these two things tend to sort of walk in a lockstep, and this is where fears come from, you know, people that might not be as optimistic and positive. So, but remember, we have a document, a founding document in New Zealand that has shifted our thinking. And when I came to New Zealand, you know, I had to get my head around some of the concepts, and very interesting, you know, to get the discussions and the different views of that. It's not a topic that is out there in the rest of the world necessarily, but when you hear people like the Danes and the Canadians in the discussions that we had, specifically the group that we had, when we talk about different ways of knowing, different ways of gathering information and so on, there is indigeneity raising its head, not nationalism. And that's interesting. That is interesting for me, because people are saying, we have a small language, we have a small this and so on. We don't want to colonize those around us, but we want to have a space in the sun. Our ways of doing have value, and we want to make that work for us. We need the space. And what's wrong with that? Nothing. And it doesn't carry a heap of fear with it, as long as, you know, people understand that it's not connected to power only.
I have some questions to end the show with. I've got lots of other questions written down to discuss with you. When you come back, Hank, we shall have to carry on.
Fantastic.
But the questions to end the show you've had before, well, we're going to ask them anyway, we can go through nice and quickly. What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Things outside of my life, Sam, that I could not engineer, being a granddad. I don't claim as a success, but I'm really happy for that, because that's one of the things that drive me forward in terms of, you know, as I get older, we have kids, grandkids, and we want to make the world a better place for them and keep on doing that. So that's it. And obviously, I mean, working in Capable has been incredibly invigorating despite all the changes and things going through. I think we have a whānau of incredible strength and diversity, and being part of that, you know, finding myself in that space is an incredible achievement for me, if you want to.
So what's your superpower?
When I see something that I don't believe is right, I can't stop before it's buried. And, you know, I have certain things like that. I get singularly focused on it till I see a shift. And I believe in bringing about change by small shuffles. I think that's a superpower where people want to see change immediately. You know, the now moment, I have an ability, although I'm incredibly impatient with myself, I have the ability for a certain slowness.
It sounds like an interesting dance, change by small shuffles. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No, that would put me in a box, you know, and they would see me coming. No, not at all. I'm a change maker, not an activist.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
My alarm clock. But seriously, the work that I do with people is very important for me. I've shifted my life from working in the tech space, where my motivation was the safety of the people that protect us, to now the space where it is about helping people to not helping. That's the wrong word. Opening doors so that people can get through there, so that they can become agentic in their own way. Because when you're agentic, you can respond to serendipity moments and you can make your contribution. And I'm hoping that I can be a catalyst in that process.
So what is the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
Slaying assessments. It's on my agenda. It is on my agenda to research that with my Danish and Canadian colleagues, to work on that whole process, the end process of these degrees, and to make sure that we find other ways of coming to the end of a process like that without it being an assessment, where there are incredible power plays at work that definitely not needed. It's just superfluous. So yes, there's research out there that shows that it can be done differently, and I will be into that.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Yeah, be hopeful. Be hopeful. You know, the noise you hear out there is not the horses of the apocalypse. It's not even the ponies of the apocalypse. It's just those of us, you know, rushing forward into the future, you know, quite optimistically. So just be optimistic and, you know, believe in the power of human ingenuity. We have this.
Thank you for that. Not the apocalypse. Those of us rushing into the future. That's a good line. Mawira.
Thank you very much for your kōrero today, for your insight, for some really interesting kōrero. And I think over the years we've known each other, we haven't always agreed on things, but I find that as time goes on, we're agreeing on more things. So one or both of us is changing, which is an interesting thing, a conversation for another day. But thank you for your being a champion for learner-centered approach, because we need that more than ever. We need that. And all the best for your travel home and for the changes that you're going to champion. We appreciate you and the work that you do. Kia ora.
Thank you very much, Mawira. I think that it's very simple. We show more and more respect as we go, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We don't have to agree, but we can respect our positions, and from that comes shifts and changes. What you
want, thank you. You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in the bubbles, their safe spaces around the world, brought to you by Sustainable Lens, who are brought to you by Otago Polytechnic Te Pūkenga. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. You can find us on Facebook. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. This is Aretha Franklin, Respect. I'm Samuel Mann at Otago Polytechnic Te Pūkenga with Mawira Karatai in Whakatane, and we've been joined by Hank Root, who is in Boston. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mati wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.